consider this. Between what we eat and what we say, we as a culture cannot hide what we are. Well, that's quite a premise. But not for a scholar like Ina Lipkowitz. Now, she sees the stories behind the foods and their words, which led to her book, Words to Eat By, Five Foods and the Culinary History of the English Language. Ina, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Ina, these five foods, what are they and why did you choose them?
Well, I chose these five for several reasons. First, I wanted to represent the major categories of the Surgeon General's food pyramid, which is now ousted by Michelle Obama's dinner plate, but I still had the food pyramid in mind.
Right.
So that bread stands in for the cereal group, apples and leeks for fruits and vegetables, milk for dairy, and meat for protein. But more importantly than that, I was drawn to these five foods because their names are among the oldest food names we've got in the English language. People have in Britain have been calling apples for thousands of years, and leek, milk, meat, and bread have been in daily use for almost as long. Most of our other food names have come to us from other peoples more recently, but these are the oldest names because these are the foods that we've been eating the longest. And one of the main ideas of the book is that you simply cannot separate foods from their names. Food names, they don't just name food, they convey attitudes that are very specific. So just think of pâté versus chopped liver, or calamari versus squid tentacles. Or if bread were sexy enough, why is the store downstairs called Panera, you know, or au bon pain? We go to other languages.
Yeah.
We Americans, we English speakers, and particularly Americans, I think, suffer from a vast inferiority complex. On the one hand, we are so taken in by Italian and French language and food. And I love the English language. I love our English words. I think we should be prouder of our English and Northern European language and heritage. And foods. And I think it's time. I see trends in the foodie world that more and more interest is going to, for instance, simpler preparations of meat. There's a wild food movement out there going back to foraged vegetables. Very interesting. Chez Panisse put a forager on its payroll. A lot of other restaurants have now followed suit.
Yeah.
Breads are going back to less controlled, more wild fermentation. Apples are going back to heirloom, not as grafted as they had been. I see all of these trends returning us to an attitude about food that's very different from what we've had in a very sophisticated Italian and French way.
Let's talk about meat, because there's a point you make that I've always wondered about. We don't eat cow. We eat beef.
Right, that's a big one. Can you imagine if instead of meatloaf we called it flesh loaf? Doesn't, you know, it would sound terrible. What we call food is matters, conveys attitude. To call it meat is to distance it from flesh, just the way to call it beef is to distance it from a cow. We don't like to think that we're eating a cow. We don't like to think that we're eating a calf or a pig. Pork from the pig, obviously, beef from the cow, veal from the calf. All those words come from French, from pork, boeuf, and veau, whereas cow, pig, and calf are all old English words.
Yeah.
So we make it sound better, more appealing, by going to a French word that distances it from the animal. In fact, that's how I begin the book, with a story of I was moving to North Carolina for a year, and I was invited to a pig picking, which sort of horrified me, to tell you the truth, because it was this great big dead animal. You couldn't think it was a tenderloin or a pork chop. It was the whole animal. And it was called a pig picking, not a pork roast. And I think the name got me as much as the thing, because pork and roast are from French, and
mm-hmm.
pig and pick mm-hmm. are old English words. There was no way I could deny what it was I was doing. But the thing was, the meat was delicious, completely delicious. And so I was drawn over to a very straightforward way of preparing it and calling it by a no-nonsense name.
There's something else that you get into in the book which seems to be a stretch, but then again it isn't. You bring religion into the picture of food mm-hmm. words.
Right, right. Well, religion, and more specifically the Bible, because the Bible, although it is obviously popular the world over, never forget that it came from the Mediterranean. Whether the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament came from a world where fruits and vegetables grew readily, where meat was by and large not the mainstay of the diet, where milk was not drunk. And when the Bible, with the religious attitudes, moved up north, it had quite a bit of problems up north, where people happily ate meat, drank milk, and saw no reason to stop doing so. So when St. Paul told people down south, oh, it is good not to eat meat, or in another one of his letters he said something like, everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness. Wean yourself of milk. Well, how are those lines going to go over up north, where people had no reason to want to stop eating meat or drinking milk? So that there were a lot of differences between the food symbolism in the Bible and food attitudes up north. And that conflict remains to this day, because people continue to eat meat and drink milk even as they read the letters telling them not to do so.
Ina, this is really fascinating. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Ina Lipkowitz is the author of Words to Eat By: Five Foods and the Culinary History of the English Language.